funny listening to that biography of myself as an introduction. I was kind of sitting here and just reflecting on the fact that I was kind of inquiring into who it is that's actually doing this meditation practice. And that sense of wonder and curiosity about, as we go through our daily lives and we come to sit, sometimes we kind of approach the meditation in the same frame of mind, and there's a certain momentum to that frame of mind as the mind and the body begin to settle. There's a sense of space opening up, and in that sense of space, sometimes the question can arise quite spontaneously, who's doing this practice? And not so much from an intellectual point of view, but just from the point of view of kind of opening our minds and our hearts to the space of not knowing, the space of simply being here in that mystery. So one of the mysteries that I would like to explore with you this evening is the mystery of happiness. Because the recognition of true happiness is really fundamental to what the Dharma is all about. And very often when we come across the teachings of the Buddha and we begin to become acquainted with those teachings, there's a certain kind of opinion or view that these teachings can be sort of life-denying in some way, such as the sense that it's all about detachment, it's all about non-attachment, it's all about seeing suffering. And sometimes we can get the idea, kind of, you know, when we approach the practice, you know, where's the heart, where's the beef of this practice, what's it about? So I'd like to talk about the relationship, the orientation of our Dharma practice to this inquiry about happiness and where happiness resides, and looking into on a variety of different ways how happiness appears, and maybe what are some of the constituents or elements that bring happiness into our lives. Some time ago, some years ago, when I was in a monastery in Southeast Asia, on an island that many of you are probably familiar with and probably have visited, Koh Samui Island, which is a resort island in the south of Thailand, I happened to find myself on a quiet monastery, in a quiet monastery surrounded by all kinds of activity. People coming for holidays, people having parties at different resorts along the beach. And it was really a stark contrast to the environment in which I was living in at the time. And there was some relationship between my world and that world, and that I used to have to go every morning to get my alms food from some of these establishments. And as I sat there and kind of settled into the spaciousness of the place, which, by the way, was extraordinarily beautiful. The monastery was called the Monastery of the Lotus Pond. And it was very quiet and serene. And you could feel the breeze coming off of the ocean. And in front of our monastery, there was a little Thai school. And every morning when I would come back from my alms rounds, all the little children in the school would line up and pay their respects. It was very sweet and very delightful place to be. And yet all around me there was all this activity, trees were being cut down, new resorts were being built, bigger hotels, more and more noise and music and excitement. And from the perspective that I was sitting with, it just was kind of mysterious to me. I couldn't really understand on some level what people felt was actually lacking, because the environment felt so full and so beautiful and so satisfying. But I think that's very much how it is with the pursuit of happiness. We very often find ourselves seeking in various ways a kind of satisfaction outside of ourselves, and in the process seem to be missing the very thing that we're searching for. And it's not only pleasure seekers on Samoy Island that have this challenge. During the life of the Buddha, there's a very key moment that it really, in some ways to me, distinguishes the Buddha Dharma from much of what went before in terms of practicing in various ascetic and renunciate traditions. And that moment comes when, after many years of arduous practice, incredible asceticism, the Buddha finds himself, and it's said that he sustained himself on just one grain of rice a day, and at which point he was so thin that you could put your finger through his tummy and touch his spine. That's how thin he was said to be at that point in his life. And he had these followers who were also ascetics, who were following this path of self-mortification and a real commitment to finding out what's true through their practices. And at this particular point, he made a decision, and he made a decision to start to eat again. And the way that that opportunity arose for him is he ran into a woman who offered him milk rice. And he decided that he needed to start eating the milk rice. And the thing that really brought that recognition, that intuition about for him, was a vision that he had, or not so much a vision, but a memory that he had from his childhood, when he was an 8-year-old boy sitting under an apple blossom tree in the fields, where his mother was working or taking care of her daily chores. And he remembered how that sense of contentment of everything that all of his physical needs being taken care of freed his mind to have this sense of deep abiding contentment. And that deep abiding contentment led to the concentration of his mind and a deepening recognition of various qualities of well-being and happiness in his life. And so he realized, having had that memory, that recollection, that he needed to start to take care of his body. He needed to nourish his body. And that choice, that decision, is really the beginning of his teaching, the particular flavor of the Buddha's teaching, which is known as the middle way. It doesn't fall into the extreme of self-mortification, nor does it fall into the extreme of self-indulgence or getting caught up in satisfying various kinds of sensual or physical desires. And so in that place, that middle ground of satisfaction, giving the body what it needs, taking care of the body, taking care of our lives, there is a deep kind of contentment that can arise. And very often we find ourselves on either side of that equation. Either we're really harsh with ourselves and beating ourselves up for not having done something right in the past, or wishing we'd perform better in a certain situation, or whatever it might be. On the other hand, we find ourselves caught up in our worldly activities and not really giving any space or any time for that sense of simply being and feeling that rich sense of fullness and contentment that can come. And another way to look at this is that, kind of more in a mythic, if we look at the Buddha's life kind of in more of a mythic way, we can see that, in a sense, that moment is the moment where the masculine quality of what we traditionally call masculine quality, both of these masculine and feminine are inside of all of us. But again, we need to find that middle ground, that middle path, where that sense of striving and will, determination, is balanced with a sense of care, a sense of nourishment, a sense of nurturing. So in some ways, we could say that one of the foundations for happiness is a sense of contentment. And one way to define contentment is that it's the absence of preoccupation. So very often we find ourselves preoccupied with worldly concerns, with making a living, with taking care of our children, all these things that we need to attend to, worrying about the future, worrying about the stock market, or maybe we've given up on that by now. You know, so we find ourselves preoccupied with all of these issues in our life and in the world. And then at the same time, we find ourselves also sometimes preoccupied or caught up in our own inner world, our own spiritual practice. And I found this for myself many times, that place where, as the Buddha was, very preoccupied with striving or trying to get somewhere, and we miss the jewel and the simplicity of that moment of contentment, that moment of simply settling back and opening to simply being and enjoying the moment in which we find ourselves. I remember a time when I was a student, undergraduate student, and this was on the East Coast, and I had just done a long retreat at the Insight Meditation Society and came back to the school right at the time of finals week. And it was really quite astounding to me to look around and to see all of these people walking around with their minds somewhere else. There was a body, but the mind was clearly somewhere else, many miles ahead. And the body was kind of lurching forward, trying to catch up with where the mind was going. That sense of preoccupation can really be stressful, can really be unsatisfying. I remember when I was traveling around India, one of the things that really touched me was how little people there had and how profoundly content many people seem to be. And I remember one particular day, early in the morning, I was walking on the street in Madras, and there had been a monsoon and had been very wet. Everywhere had been, was soaked. And just as I was walking down the street, this little girl came out of a cardboard box, because she was actually living in that cardboard box with her family. She came out of that cardboard box, and I met her gaze, and there was just all this joy. So for me, that was an incredible moment of teaching. And I think sometimes some of my greatest teachings in India just came from witnessing and being around the children that you would see there. And that natural sense of childish enthusiasm, childlike enthusiasm and delight. So how do we lose touch with that? How does that get obscured? I remember when I was still ordained in Thailand, one of the things that I dreaded was the times when which happened a couple of times during the time I was in robes, when my parents decided that they would pay me a visit. And it was always kind of an awkward time for both of us, them seeing me with my shaved head and robes, me seeing them, and particularly for my mother, who was absolutely convinced that she needed to deprogram me from the cult that I was connected with. And I took them to see my teacher, who was one of the most well-known monastics in Thailand at the time, Ajahn Buddhadasa. And I thought it was going to be difficult for them to understand, and I felt it had been difficult for them to understand what I was doing, because they come from such a kind of rational, sort of scientific model of how the world works. And so we went to see Ajahn Buddhadasa, and I said to him, you know, my father might have a hard time understanding about Buddhism because he's a scientist. And without any hesitation, Ajahn Buddhadasa shot back, well, if he's a scientist, he should understand it very easily. And that really kind of sunk in for me, because in some way, the Buddhist teaching is really the science of happiness. It's looking into and discriminating between ways of being which increase our sense of happiness and satisfaction, and ways of being where we find ourselves really caught in a cycle of discontent and dissatisfaction. One of the key discriminations that we make in our practice is the discrimination between skillful and unskillful actions, and skillful and unskillful practices and speech, all of the different ways we interact in the world, we can do that either skillfully or unskillfully. And as we begin to bring our mindfulness to examine and explore what qualities bring more happiness and what qualities kind of tend to become, take us into a cycle of more and more frustration, we can begin to investigate this issue of happiness in a deeper way. In the Buddhist teachings, desire has kind of a bad name. Grasping desire is seen as the cause of dissatisfaction, of dis-ease, of suffering. So how does that come about? How does desire obscure our minds? Well, I remember when I was a child, one of the things that I really loved, and I don't know why, was blue popsicles. And when the ice cream truck would come, somehow the thought of a blue popsicle would just pop into my mind. And everything about seeking this blue popsicle and getting the blue popsicle and tasting that particular flavor, I don't even know what flavor that was.
Licorice.
I don't think it was licorice.
It was licorice.
You like blue popsicles as well? There was such a sense of joy that arose with that. And so in our lives, what tends to happen is we associate that state of satisfaction, that state of calm and fullness, with the object that we are desiring or longing for. And we don't realize, actually, that it's simply that the conditions of getting what we want allow for a quality of contentment, a quality of satisfaction to arise in the mind. So one of the things that we can do with our practice is we can begin to examine, to investigate what happens around desire. What happens when we get what we want? What happens when we don't get what we want? How does that operate inside of us? And one of the kind of ways that I like to think about it is to discriminate between joy and desire. When we're enjoying something, when we're really present with it, when we're really feeling fully awake to it, there's a quality of childlike joy. But when we're imagining and thinking about what it is that we would like to have and that we don't have, there's a sense of preoccupation. There's a sense of things not being the way we want them to be and of our minds being pulled out of the present. For example, if you've ever had that experience of walking into a restaurant and having the dessert tray pass your table while you're eating dinner, sometimes it's really hard to focus on your dinner because you keep on thinking about what you're going to have for dessert. Just that sense of the mind moving out and away from what's happening, from that sense of contentment. Happiness and contentment have a very, very different flavor to them, a very different movement, if you will. Another story from my time in Thailand, I went with a friend to a monastery in the south of Thailand, and I was really struck because I was sitting there with the teacher, the Ajahn, and all around his room, there were these pictures of people who had been really violently killed in car accidents, all kinds of, you know, very morose images of death and destruction. And it just really struck me how incredibly happy and delighted we all were sitting there. And everyone seemed to be so much enjoying that particular moment with all of these really incredibly disconcerting images around. And I suddenly realized, or it dawned on me, that part of that is just recognizing that there really isn't anything that we need to hold on to. As another Thai teacher, Ajahn Chah, likes to say, if you think of the cup, say we're talking about like our teacup, if we're really attached to our teacup, if we think of that cup as already broken, then it relieves us of all of the dissatisfaction around trying to hold on to that, trying to keep it the way we want it to be. And likewise, I was kind of struck by the incredible sense of ease and openness that comes when we're able to feel a sense of letting go in our hearts. Another quality that's associated with the sense of contentment is the quality of kind of generosity of spirit. This last weekend, I went to an event in Marin County, and you probably have one down here as well, in San Mateo. It's called the Marin Human Race. And there were all kinds of people there with their nonprofit booths. There were all kinds of people that came for the day to the race. And it was a beautiful day. And all of the food that was offered was free, freely offered. And people were having a really fun time. And the race, in my case the walk, was really wonderful. And as I left, I just kind of felt like, wow, there's just this sense of kind of an outpouring of generosity, both the intention for having the race, the quality of the way that people were relating to one another. And I think that one of the things in the Dharma practice that really support that sense of contentment is a kind of generosity of spirit, which is very much the foundation of our practice, insofar as the teachings are given freely, they're supported out of great generosity and kindness and dedication, and there's a real flow back and forth in that way. So both in the giving and the receiving, it's a tremendous sense of openness and generosity. And both in terms of our practice, in terms of our recognition of the value of other sentient living beings through our practice of sila or basic precepts, and respect for life. There's a sense of generosity and a sense of kindness that all of our actions really demonstrate, as well as in the actual practice of dana, of generosity itself. But there's also a deeper, more subtle kind of generosity of spirit, you might say. Kind of an open-hearted interest or wonder about our experience. When we're not preoccupied, when we can really be with whatever is there to be with, whether it's our breath or another person, when we can give our whole attention, our full attention to something, there's a kind of generosity, a kind of letting go of our preoccupation with what's going on over here, with what I need right now. And there's kind of an offering of our full attention, which is the spirit of the Dharma practice, is to really give our attention. And when we, say, for example, pay attention to our breath and use the practice of mindfulness of breathing, it's really a way of, first of all, kind of stopping or interrupting that kind of trance of self-preoccupation. And it also gives us something very real, very alive, very immediate to give our attention to. And if you think about how that works in how it affects our minds, it's really quite different than the way that our culture has been encouraging us or inviting us to relate to happiness, to pleasure, to contentment. Because usually we're looking for more and more stimulation, and once our minds get kind of dull to a certain degree of stimulation, then it gets sort of amped up, so that we now find that no matter how violent or intense different kinds of films or movies or television are, for many people, it hardly even registers, because it's kind of an equivalent dulling of the senses, dulling of the sense of openness. Whereas as we give our attention to our breath, to our experience, there's a kind of deepening of that sensitivity and that capacity to really connect and feel on subtler and subtler levels what's going on. And as we give our full attention to that, there's an opportunity for that interest to grow. And in the movement of the Dharma practice, joy actually follows that interest. So that as we become more and more interested in our breath or in nature or in whatever is happening right now, what we're feeling, as we deepen that sense of interest, also there's a sense of joy that arises. And the unfolding and the development of joy is very much tied to that ability to give of ourselves, that kind of openness. And it's maybe childlike, but not childish, because there's very clear and subtle discriminations that we're able to make as we give attention to the breath or to the body sensations or to our feelings. And as that grows, the joy also grows. So, just to give you an example, I listed down 5 different kinds of joy and how that quality of joy develops as our practice opens. The first is that sort of sense of interest that I was talking about. Just starting with a slight sense of interest in what we're attending to, what we're giving our attention to. And that grows into momentary joy, where we just feel like a moment of upliftment, of excitement. that growth turns into a kind of oscillating and recurring flood of joy, which can then become kind of ecstatic, thrilling, and then opening up into an all-pervading joy that suffuses, that drenches the whole body. But all of this starts with a sense of allowing ourselves to rest in that contentment, in that sense of satisfaction, of not being preoccupied or having an agenda. So from the Dharma, a dharmic point of view, the development of happiness is not so much something to seek or to look for. It's more something that we can cultivate, as though we were cultivating the garden of our minds and hearts. And as we cultivate that sense of satisfaction, that precious opportunity to give our attention to our experience, that sense of contentment, letting go, and a generosity of spirit accompanied with this openness and interest can begin to develop in us. We can begin to feel a sense of satisfaction and delight and a sense of fullness that comes with that. In our Dharma practice, or in the traditional classical teachings, this recognition helps us to see that actually the joy is not dependent on any external object, but is really dependent on cultivating what are called beautiful mind states, these qualities of openness, contentment, that come from this kind of simplicity, childlike simplicity and innocence. But even those mind states can be something that we find ourselves preoccupied with and wanting to kind of have more, or feel that we want to grasp after. And so to the extent that we grasp hold of or try to hold on to these states, again, to that extent, we find ourselves back in the same old pattern of kind of moving in the direction of grasping and being preoccupied. So we get preoccupied with our own sense of joy, wanting to increase it, wanting to hold on to it. That can also create a sense of separation. In a sense, we can't really grasp happiness. And there's some kind of something very beautiful about that truth, that we can't really grasp or have happiness. Happiness is something that we can be. It's something that is not really a state that can be grasped hold of, but is more a product of a mind and heart that is open and receptive to every moment of experience. Regardless of whether it's a moment of ecstatic joy or of discomfort or dis-ease, it's that quality of receptivity, of openness, of generosity of spirit, really of letting go, that allows for happiness to deepen in us. In some year, many years ago, a Zen monk went to Thailand and decided to go into retreat in a cave there, and actually ended up dying in that cave. And he painted a picture on the wall of his cave, which was reproduced at the monastery where I was staying, at Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery, because there he has something called the spiritual museum with all kinds of like interesting Dharma teaching kind of works of art and pithy teachings. And this painting that was reproduced in the what was called the spiritual theater, I believe. And he had all the whole monastery actually had these kinds of things all around it. Like he had built a boat in like a ship out of concrete in the middle of the monastery. And it never was finished. There was all these metal rods sticking out of it. It really didn't make any sense why it was even there in the first place. And people would always ask him, you know, when are you going to finish that? And he said, what do you mean? What's there is already finished. So he had all of these kind of teachings in his spiritual theater. And one was this reproduced painting from the wall of the cave of this Zen monk who had come to practice there many years ago and had died in the cave. And the picture was a picture of a smiling, beaming, kind of roly-poly Buddha image, full of joy and happiness. And underneath it was the words, oh, what joy it is to know there is no happiness in the world. Oh, what joy it is to know there is no happiness in the world. So what that's really pointing to for us is to recognize that happiness really isn't a thing. It's not really a mind state particularly, and it's certainly not something that we can grasp a hold of in the world. But really, these qualities of contentment, qualities of letting go and generosity, and qualities of openness, open-heartedness. So I'd like to end this evening with a poem from Naomi Shihab Nye called So Much Happiness. It is difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. With sadness, there is something to rub against, a wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands, like ticket stubs or change. But happiness floats. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Happiness lands on the roof of the next house singing and disappears when it wants to. You are happy either way. Even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches and love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and scratched records. Since there is no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug, you raise your hands, and it flows out of you into everything you touch. You are not responsible. You take no credit, as the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it, and in that way be known. So we can just sit together for a minute. So I want to thank you all for your attention. And again, it's really a pleasure to have the opportunity to sit together. Thank you very much. Hope to see you again.